Hi, it's Mountain Edition, all the news from the week here in the Roaring Fork Valley and from around the state. Coming at you in the next half hour, I'm Zoe Rome and I'm here with Wyatt Orme.
Hi, Zoe.
Hi, Wyatt. We had some exciting midterm elections on Tuesday, and the Aspen Public Radio news team covered the races, the results, and the stories beyond the ballot. Stories you might not be expecting, like how exactly are ballots counted?
Voters across the state rejected a slew of ballot measures, from transportation bonds to increased restrictions for oil and gas development.
Those stories and more coming up on Mountain Edition. Okay, Wyatt, let's talk some election results. Colorado voters were asked to fill out a really long ballot.
It was really long.
Let's go over some of the results that might be of particular interest to people here in the Roaring Fork Valley that are listening. Voters from Aspen to Newcastle approved ballot issue 7A. This implements a property tax to support the Roaring Fork Transportation Authority, also known as RAFTA. The results were really close, 52% to 48%. RAFTA will receive funds for electric buses, maintenance, and building a trail from Glenwood Springs to Newcastle.
And that's the LOVA trail,
that's
right?
That's the LOVA trail.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so Colorado Mountain College now has the authority to adjust its tax rate in certain circumstances. Voters in all six of the college's counties overwhelmingly approved a measure that allows the school's board of trustees to adjust their mill levy rate. CMC says this is a way to prevent losing money because of Colorado's Gallagher Amendment.
Right. And Carrie Donovan won State Senate District 5 over her challenger, Olin Lund. In the State House District 26 race, incumbent Democrat Dylan Roberts won re-election. He says he focused on health insurance in his first term and that he will continue to do so. He says he'll look to pass some legislation that could involve a public insurance option or insurance co-ops.
What I want to keep working on, and it's what I think has a significant momentum to get passed, is increasing competition in the insurance market. Right now, too many families in these two counties and in the whole western Colorado region have no choice when they're buying on the individual market.
In House District 57, Republican incumbent Bob Rankin will return to the state house to represent Rio Blanco, Moffat, and Garfield counties. Rankin captured over 60% of the vote. Garfield County libraries will add new materials to their shelves this next year. 73% of voters approved ballot issue 6A, which allows libraries to retain funds that they formerly had to give back to property owners because of Colorado's Tabor Law. The library district will spend this money on new books, ebooks, and also audiobooks. Lots of books for the Garfield County Library is coming.
Lots of new books. Congressman Scott Tipton will be returning to Washington, D.C. to represent the Western Slope and all of Colorado's 3rd District. Tipton beat Democratic challenger Diane Mitch Bush, a former state house rep and county commissioner. Democrats fared well in Colorado during Tuesday's midterm elections, from the governor's race to congressional races to state house races. Many of the Republican incumbents who represent Garfield County were reelected. How much of a fight did the Democrats put up?
I think the answer is a pretty good one, but it obviously was not strong enough to change the status quo much. Take Tom Jankowski, for example. He just won his 3rd term as a Garfield County commissioner, and he and I sat down at the end of Tuesday evening right after he was ready to declare victory, and he said that this was by far the most competitive race that he's had. He said that Paula Stepp, his opponent, had a lot of momentum going for her, and that momentum really carried her through most of the fall.
I just think just as far as backing, volunteers, excitement, synergy, I think those things were in my opponent's favor at the start of the campaign.
Jankowski says that he thinks that Paula Stepp's momentum really kind of slowed down based on her decision not to oppose Proposition 112. And he thinks that that is what ultimately made the most difference.
And to clarify, Proposition 112 was the proposition to increase setback distances from new oil and gas development. And that failed last night.
That's exactly right. And Jankowski was opposed to Proposition 112 for the entirety of the race. He told me that because his race was so close, that it is making him think about his constituency a little differently. He thinks that the fact that the Democrats did as well as they did is really showing some changes in demographics in Garfield County.
Did he say that this would lead to any sort of policy change?
He didn't say that the race was going to make him rethink any of his policy positions. He says the things that he's hoping to accomplish in his next term, he's been hoping to accomplish for a while. That includes getting some public transportation from Parachute and Battlement Mesa to Rifle. He also wants to see the Jordan Cove export terminal built in Oregon, which he plans to advocate for. So the policies that he's going for seem unchanged.
So how are Garfield County Democrats feeling at this point?
On election night, I stopped by their watch party in Glenwood Springs, and I talked to Gretchen Brogdon. She's the chair of the Garfield County Democrats. And she told me that Democrats in Garfield County are voting at a higher rate than they have in a while. And she also thinks that there are way more left-leaning independent voters in the county than people think. They just haven't been voting. Let's have a listen.
We opened an office in Rifle this year, and we have had more and more people show up to that office and say, thank you for showing up here. We didn't know there was anybody else in this area when there are thousands of Democrats and left-leaning progressives in Western Garfield.
But obviously the Democrats, they didn't win.
That's right. There's not much change as far as representation in Garfield County goes. Most of the Republican incumbents won. Bob Rankin beat Colin Wilhelm. There wasn't much of a competition there. Rankin is a long-serving representative, and he's deep in statewide education issues and is also working to overturn the Gallagher Amendment, which is really unpopular in the western half of the state. Scott Tipton beat Diane Mitz-Busch. Mitz-Busch did better than Tipton's previous opponent, Gail Schwartz. So it was a more narrow victory than his previous one. But one thing that we did see is that Jared Polis, who's a Democrat and is also the next governor of Colorado, carried Garfield County just slightly over Republican candidate Walker Stapleton.
Colorado voters showed an overwhelming support for the Democratic Party on Tuesday night. But as KUNC's Esther Honig reports, voters were far more conservative when it came to left-leaning ballot issues, which sought to fund education, transportation, and further regulate the oil and gas industry.
On the morning after the highly anticipated 2018 midterms, friends Pam Whittall, Tom Moore, and David Ahn gathered around a small table at the Linden Street Cafe in Old Town Fort Collins, something they do most mornings.
Monday, Wednesday, Fridays.
After yoga class.
Between sips of coffee, they talked about the outcomes of Tuesday's election. They're pretty pleased overall with the dozens of Democratic candidates that Coloradans elected last night, including the new governor, Jared Polis.
Hardworking, open-minded individual. We need more of those in politics.
But Whittall is also a bit disappointed.
And the initiatives didn't turn out the way we would have hoped.
What in particular were you looking at?
Well, the school one, for sure. 73, I think that was.
This election, the more progressive measures were defeated, including Amendment 73 and Proposition 110, which proposed raising taxes to fund public education and transportation. And perhaps one of the most hotly contested issues, Prop 112, did not pass. It would have increased the distance of new oil and gas drilling from homes to 2,500 feet.
You can buy anything, because that's why it didn't pass, I think.
David Ahn is talking about the money that was spent opposing 112, roughly $40 million that came mostly from the oil industry. While 56% of voters oppose the measure, organizers for Prop 112 say they'll continue to push for what they say are common sense regulations, perhaps in the next election. Across Old Town, a veteran of the U.S. Navy and Fort Collins native, Norm Cook, is sipping on his morning coffee at Starbucks. At 79, he says he tries to stay away from the pastries.
Sometimes a blueberry scone.
He's already pored over last night's results in this morning's paper. He wasn't rooting for either party, but thinks the winning candidates are strong.
I'm more interested in the person than the party, really.
If Colorado's voter turnout were a pie, there'd be a slice for Republicans and a slice for Democrats, but the biggest piece would go to the unaffiliated voters, like Cook, who had their highest turnout ever. Cook didn't vote for the new governor, Jared Polis, who is now the first openly gay governor in the country.
Well, that's okay, you know. That doesn't mean he won't do a good job. That doesn't happen to be my preference of lifestyle, but that's his business.
In neighboring Weld County, the morning crowd at Butters, a local diner, is sitting down to plates of sausage omelets and French toast. Josh Hamblin is here with his wife and two young kids. His thoughts on the new governor?
No comment.
Okay. Republican candidate Walker Stapleton won the Eastern Plains, including Weld County, as well as most of the Western Slope. But it was a blue streak that runs through the state along the Front Range that decided the race. And that's troubling for Hamblin.
I hate seeing Colorado go to the Democratic side.
According to some pundits, Colorado may continue to be a friendly place for the Democratic Party in the future, especially if trends in population diversity and education attainment continue to climb. In historically conservative counties like Weld, voters like Hamblin are concerned by what could be a growing cultural shift. But he says there is one silver lining from the election, the failure of Prop 112.
I mean, that's our family livelihood.
Like many in the region, Hamblin works in the oil industry.
I think the oil and gas industry did a great job educating the public to let them know how big of a devastation it'd be to the economy.
As a conservative, he's disappointed by Colorado's new political representation. But he says the failure of the more progressive ballot initiatives is in his favor. Esther Honig, KUNC.
You're listening to Mountain Edition from Aspen Public Radio News. I'm Wyatt Orm.
And I'm Zoe Rome. Wyatt, our dedicated Aspen Public Radio listeners are engaged with what's going on in their communities, and that's why they tune in to all of our programming, including Mountain Edition, where we take them back over what happened this past week.
That's right. Mountain Edition is one of many ways that listeners can stay up to date with what's going on. They can also go to our Facebook page, and while you're there, don't hesitate to like it. We also have a Twitter account for all of you voracious social media consumers out there listening. Our handle is @AspenPubRadio.
On our Facebook page, you can interact with our station through comments on our posts or by just messaging us directly.
You can get your local news throughout the day online at aspenpublicradio.org. Go deeper into the stories that you hear on air with slideshows, extended interviews, and breaking news updates. You can also stream your favorite local public affairs show, like Valley Roundup, for example, online at aspenpublicradio.org. Colorado is one of three states that conducts elections by mail. Every registered voter receives a ballot in their mailbox ahead of Election Day. They can then mail their ballots back in or place them in an official drop box. Then the fun starts. It's up to a team of volunteer election judges to make sure ballots get securely and accurately counted. It takes 250 volunteers and elected officials to pull this off in Pitkin County. Zoe has the story.
90% of Pitkin County voters either mail in their ballots or drop them off. Ray Parrots is dropping off his ballot at the Pitkin County Administration Building.
It's the sound of democracy in action.
Tracy Murtaugh sits at the election table. She's responsible for greeting people as they come into the polls and showing them where to drop off their ballot. She makes sure they've signed the back of their envelope and has them sign in as well. Once a ballot like Parrots gets dropped into the box, it is carried down with others to the basement of the administration building. Pitkin County Clerk and Recorder Janice Voss-Caudill is in charge of Pitkin County elections. She leads me down a flight of stairs through a locked door that only five people can open.
What people don't know is the security that we have in place.
A downstairs conference room is transformed into a high-tech fortress. There's 24/7 video surveillance and several workstations with computers. Stacks of bright red boxes full of ballots line temporary shelves around the walls. It looks like the administrative wing of Santa's workshop. Two women are poring over a computer and stack of white envelopes. Their job is to look at the signatures on the outside of the envelopes. These judges work in partisan pairs, one Democrat and one Republican. If both judges agree that something with the signature is off, they'll reject it, and the voter will be notified that they need to fix or cure their ballot. After elections, uncured ballots are forwarded to the district attorney's office. Accepted ballots move on to the next workstation. Three judges working along a disassembly line remove the ballot from the envelope it arrives in, like taking apart a Russian nesting doll. The first person unseals the large envelope and takes out the ballot that's still in its secrecy sleeve. They hand that over to the next judge. That person removes the ballot from the secrecy sleeve and hands it to the last judge, who makes sure there are no identifying marks like a signature or initials on the actual ballot.
It's a process that assures anonymity for each voter.
Then a judge takes the ballots to another locked room. They're fed in batches through one of just two counting machines. The counting machines are actually just off-the-shelf scanners, the kind you would get at any office supply store. They're attached to a computer that analyzes the ballots. If it detects a problem, like a double vote or an accidental mark,
then we'll kick it out. Two judges on the computer will sit down, Democrat, Republican, and determine what the voter intent is.
When those judges reach a decision, they'll manually put it in the computer. While the idea of a volunteer having this kind of access might sound scary, Voss Caudill says this is part of why we should trust the election process. It's run by our neighbors.
They are our integrity of our elections because they help us maintain and keep that integrity.
Votes are tallied in a single computer that is completely disconnected from the internet so that it's not susceptible to cyber attacks. And while no system is perfect, Voss Caudill says this one is pretty darn safe.
So you have to get through getting into our building, getting to through access codes on doors that record everything with surveillance and know how to get in our systems that have two-factor authentication. You need passwords and codes.
It would be hard to hack, but even if it was, it would leave behind clues. Every time ballots change hands, every time a door is opened, that action is recorded in a log. And even after the polls close, people are working to ensure that votes are safe and accurate. Ballots are kept for months after elections, just in case there's a problem. And then they're audited. Sample batches are pulled and analyzed to be sure they're statistically similar to the overall totals. If something doesn't look quite right, there could be a recount. With all these measures in place, Voss Caudill says the most important part is that people show up and vote and get their sticker.
It is all about the sticker.
Communities looking to create less trash often turn to the three R's: reduce, reuse, recycle. One company is trying to get a C in there, too, compost, and it's getting some help from the state of Colorado. Elizabeth Stewart Severy reports.
Nearly 40% of the trash that ends up buried in the Pitkin County landfill could have been composted. Local compost company Evergreen Zero Waste won a grant for $120,000 in October. Much of that will go toward commercial bear-proof dumpsters to keep area wildlife out of the compost bins. Alyssa Reindel is co-founder of Evergreen Zero Waste. She says composting hasn't taken off in the valley, so the company is aiming to reach big producers of food waste.
We can collect more from a grocery store in one stop than we can an entire neighborhood of single-family homes.
The grant money will target expanding service and providing safe containers at restaurants, grocery stores, and schools across the Roaring Fork Valley. Elizabeth Stewart Severy, Aspen Public Radio Environment Desk.
Last Friday, Carbondale celebrated Dia de los Muertos, or Day of the Dead. The Mexican holiday honors friends and family members who have died. Aspen Santa Fe Baile Folklorico performed traditional Mexican dances in a procession down Main Street and at Thunder River Theater. Kristen Kay attended a rehearsal and found that Folklorico teaches students to both honor tradition and transcend cultural barriers.
Inside a small dance studio at the 3rd Street Center, the young students of Baile Folklorico, both white and Latino, face the mirror at the front. They wear pointed dance shoes with metal taps, but everything is silent except for the voice of their teacher, Francisco Navarro's Bregueño, or Paco, to his dancers. He's going over the steps for a dance called Los Diablos, or the Devils. It's only performed on Dia de los Muertos. It's a procession of sorts, meant to clear away bad spirits so that the souls of loved ones can return to the world of the living. For Navarro's Bregueño, Los Diablos is an especially meaningful traditional dance.
That dance is going to be the connection for all those people who went to another level or energy, I want to say that, and they're going to come back because we're going to celebrate them, and they're going to be with us again.
At Navarro's Bregueño's word, his students run to form two lines. When the music starts, they go into character as mischievous devils, stomping along and swinging their arms. They look thrilled to be in dance class, even though it's after school on a Friday. Navarro's Bregueño knows the feeling. When he was a child in Chihuahua, Mexico, Folklorico helped him find a place where he belonged.
My mom was a single mom who has to work, and she put me in after school program. The same thing my kids are doing here.
He says he had an instructor who mentored him. He became so passionate that he started Ballet Folklorico 17 years ago with Aspen Santa Fe Ballet. And Dia de los Muertos this year will be important to him for another reason. His former Folklorico teacher, the one who inspired him to become an instructor, passed away earlier this year. He can't think of a better way to honor her than by passing along Folklorico to his students. And he's confident that even the youngest of them, kindergartners, can learn traditional dance.
I think it's the best age to start dancing because they start getting like dynamics in their body, how their body works, like the legs, the stamping, the heads, how they clap, how they snap. And then later on, they start getting steps and they keep going. I mean, they start loving it.
That is exactly what happened to student Solana Teitler. She remembers watching Ballet Folklorico practice at her elementary school.
I would sit in the cafeteria and watch them dance, and I loved it so much. And the rule was that you could only start dancing in kindergarten, but I was just so excited to join that Paco let me start a year early. So I started when I was 4.
That was 14 years ago. Teitler says there's more to her love of Folklorico than just the steps. She says that all the dancers and families in her group are her family.
It has given me a completely different perspective, and especially like as an Angla in our community, I think it's really important to bridge gaps, and it has definitely given me that opportunity.
Angel Romero Nahara has been dancing since kindergarten. He's 12 now. He also says that the best part of Folklorico is how tight-knit the group is.
You're a family and you work together. You won't be left out.
Tonight, for Dia de los Muertos, the Folklorico family is getting a bit bigger. The Los Diablos dance originated in Mexico's Guerrero region. Some former members of this African-Mexican community now live in Carbondale. They've been teaching the Folklorico students the dance and will perform it themselves tonight. Solana Teitler says it's just another example of how the art of dance can bring people together.
Because our community is so diverse, it's important that we celebrate all of the different traditions that form it.
Instructor Paco Navarez-Burgueño says that he's looking forward to having bystanders appreciate the hard work of his students as they dance by on Main Street.
The footwork of the kids, the expression in their bodies, the passion they do in these dances.
That footwork and that passion will clear the way for lost loved ones and bring together a community tonight. Kristen Kay, Edlis Neeson Arts and Culture Desk. The Arts and Culture Desk at Aspen Public Radio is funded by the Stefan Edlis and Gail Neeson Foundation with a mission to support the arts, community, and outreach.
This is Mountain Edition on Aspen Public Radio. I'm Wyatt Orm.
And I'm Zoe Rome. To see our news team's comprehensive election coverage, head to our website, aspenpublicradio.org.
And check out our newest show. It's called Airtime. We at Aspen Public Radio spend our days talking to very interesting people. They might live here or they might just be visiting.
And what listeners don't know is that only a fraction of those conversations make it into the programming you hear every morning. So Airtime is a show where we bring you those long, in-depth conversations that might just not have a place in the daily news cycle.
Take a listen online at aspenpublicradio.org, or you can also tune in on Wednesdays at 3:30.
Today, Pitkin County's Healthy Rivers Board will hear a proposal from the Colorado River District to expand cloud seeding activities. Elizabeth Stewart Severy explains how this weather modification process works.
The clouds responsible for snowstorms can be pretty inefficient.
A lot of the moisture can just move away from the area where we would like it to snow.
Dave Kanzer is an engineer with the Colorado River District. He says there's a way to increase the productivity of moisture-rich clouds. Cloud seeding involves adding more particles for flakes to form around. The process starts on the ground. When weather conditions like winds and temperatures in the clouds are right, meteorologists turn on generators. These blow a solution of silver iodide into air rising above the mountains, into the clouds. The silver iodide crystals can become the seed around which snowflakes grow.
And anywhere within a 15-mile range, typically that snow would fall out of the clouds.
Kanzer says the science is clear, but the process is not precise. A study conducted in Wyoming shows the conditions are only right in about 30% of storms. But when they are, cloud seeding can increase snowfall, and that snowpack contributes to water supply.
Even if we only increase the water supply by a small fraction, it can have wide-ranging benefits.
Kanzer says those benefits range from more water in local rivers to more snow on the mountains. And the River District wants to see more cloud seeding activities in the Aspen area. Kanzer is presenting a proposal to water officials from Aspen and Picking County, as well as Aspen Skiing Company. Rich Berkeley, vice president of mountain operations for SkiCo, says the company is interested in supporting the River District, but not as a business investment. The small increase in snowfall doesn't translate to extra powder days for skiers and riders.
You know, a 10-inch storm going to a 10.5-inch storm doesn't really do too much.
While cloud seeding might not be a boon for powder skiers, the company has offered to participate as a site for the generators and to help with manpower to operate them. The River District is looking for funding from Pitkin County's Healthy Rivers Board and the City of Aspen, and then the proposal would need a permit from the state of Colorado. Elizabeth Stewart-Severy, Aspen Public Radio Environment Desk.
The Mid-Valley is getting its own newspaper next month. The Aspen Daily News is launching the Roaring Fork Weekly Journal. It'll serve Basalt, Willits, and El Jebel. Wyatt sat down with the paper's publisher, David Cook, to learn more about its Down Valley expansion.
Being a publisher of a newspaper, how do you know that there's a market? How do you say, this place needs a newspaper, and this could be profitable for us?
Obviously, as you drive through the Mid-Valley, you see hustle, bustle, cranes, development, and it just so happens to be the only community not served by an independent voice that is directed towards them. It's my wholehearted intention to do a Spanish-speaking section of this paper. It's the Hispanic population in the community is, I think, well underserved, is certainly as far as the written product. There's certainly some broadcast outlets that serve that community, but I view it as a very, very important and underserved portion of our community, and I hope to fill that void as well.
Is Aspen interested in that news? I mean, you can kind of create a publication for the Mid-Valley, read by the Mid-Valley, but do you think it has broader appeal for all of the Roaring Fork Valley?
You know, I think the issues that are actually facing Basalt are, you know, right now they have something of a blank canvas. They have an opportunity to really define themselves, you know, and I think that having your own voice via a news product really kind of is sort of the cornerstone of that.
That's all for Mountain Edition this week. I'm Wyatt Orme.
And I'm Zoe Rome. AspenPublicRadio.org is your one-stop shop for local, national, and world headlines. All of our on-air news stories are archived online, so you never miss a newscast. You can even stream or podcast shows like this one and NPR special reports, browse photo slideshows, and find supplemental links to further coverage. Go deeper, go to AspenPublicRadio.org.
Join us tomorrow at 3:30 for Valley Roundup, when host Allison Bechtesh sits down with David Krause from the Aspen Times and Curtis Wackerly, editor of the Aspen Daily News, to recap this week's midterm elections.
Thanks for listening. Mountain Edition is a production of Aspen Public Radio News.